Puget Lowlands forests have been home to dense populations of Coast Salish peoples for a very long time. The sites discussed today lie on the traditional lands of many of these, including the Tsleil-Waututh, Musqueam, Tsuminus, Stolo, Squamish, Suquamish, Muckleshoot, Duwamish, Stillaguamish, Puyallup, Saanich, Tsawwassen, Tulalip, Samish, Lummi, Suquamish, and Skagit. In 1980, Haida artist Bill Reed unveiled one of the world's great sculptures in a former artillery casemate that forms the foundation of the University of British Columbia's Museum of Anthropology. Entitled The Raven and the First Man, it depicts the Haida creation story at the critical moment when Raven, intrigued by some small creatures hidden inside a clamshell, opens the shell and coaxes those creatures, the first humans, into the wider world. Raven's inquisitiveness rings true with anyone who has spent time around these highly intelligent birds, and all of us can identify with the mix of timidity and fascination on the faces of the humans emerging from the shell. Maybe I'm biased as a scientist, but it's hard for me not to see the piece as a representation of the creative power of curiosity. Regardless of how the sculpture speaks to you, the overall effect is breathtaking, a testament not only to Reed's skill, but to the complex and beautiful traditions of Northwest Coast art. It is as stunning as any statue from ancient Greece or Renaissance Italy, but unlike Winged Victory or the Pietà, it is carved not from stone, but from wood. Just as Michelangelo released his figures from Carrara marble, Reed's giant raven and tiny humans emerged from a massive log of yellow cedar. From the moment that humans first set foot in North America to the present day, the wood, bark, and leaves of trees have provided the raw material for Northwest artists. But trees don't just provide the physical basis of regional culture. They are one of the major inspirations for that culture, as attested to by another museum a few miles east of UBC in Vancouver, the city's art gallery. The gallery is home to one of the largest collections of paintings by Emily Carr, a prominent Canadian artist active at the turn of the 20th century. She was fascinated by many aspects of the Northwest landscape, most famously its indigenous art, but it's her trees that I've always loved. They're almost always there in the background, but they're not bit players in her art. They are very much alive, rising menacingly around comparatively tiny buildings, contorting in gusts of wind, forming a dark green veil around totem poles, but always integral parts of the painting. Being surrounded by enormous, vibrant, even active trees that define the world around them is a feeling familiar to any Northwesterner, and forests have inspired much of our best visual art, literature, and even music. It's not just in the realm of art that trees take on importance in the Northwest. The shore of the Salish Sea, from Vancouver to Olympia, is the most densely populated part of the region, and trees are a big reason why so many people live here, and have done so for millennia. As we'll see in a later episode, one species in particular formed the foundation of indigenous life here, and it was timber that drew many immigrants to the area and that fueled urban growth. This is most clear in Seattle, where the term Skid Row originated to describe the slippery path down which felled trees were slid to Henry Yesler's sawmill on the waterfront, and where a young William Boeing founded his aircraft company due to the proximity of limitless amounts of raw materials, which in those days meant wood. As the timber industry has faded, forests remain as important to Northwesterners as ever, with ease of access to the outdoors being one of the most frequently cited reasons that people enjoy living here. Even our largest cities preserve pockets of preserved old growth, as in Vancouver's Stanley Park, Seattle's Seward Park, and Tacoma's Point Defiance Park. A walk in these woods, the remnants of an ecosystem known to ecologists as Puget Lowland forests, will take you past a huge diversity of plants. Sword fern, big leaf maple, madrona, arbutus to our Canadian listeners. But the forests are dominated by a particular group of trees. It's the same group that acted as a medium for indigenous artists, that inspired Emily Carr and countless others, whose straight trunks and enormous size appealed to industrialists like Yesler and Boeing, and that remains synonymous with the forests we love. These trees are conifers, and they are the literal and figurative foundations of Northwest forests. 11 species of conifer thrive in the Puget Lowlands, but 3 are especially common and characterize the forests surrounding the Salish Sea: Douglas fir, western hemlock, and western red cedar. Elsewhere in the Northwest, you might encounter other members of the group, like Pacific yew, ponderosa pine, Sitka spruce, juniper, or tamarack. We'll spend much of the rest of this series exploring the many ways in which these trees define and shape the region's natural and human communities. But let's start by defining conifers themselves. What unites this diverse group of plants, and what sets them apart from other trees? Conveniently, there are 2 defining traits visible on nearly any conifer: cones and needles. The humble pine cone, or fir cone, or hemlock cone, or cedar cone, is the result of one of the most important innovations in plant evolutionary history. Early land plants relied on water to disperse their reproductive cells, spores, eggs, and sperm, leaving them tied to wet environments. Tiny pollen grains, released by male cones, can be dispersed by the wind, allowing cone-bearing plants, known as gymnosperms, to colonize new, drier habitats. Another potential danger to many early land plants was that young plants grew without any sort of protective structure around them, leaving them vulnerable to drying out, as well as to any herbivorous animals. Female cones, the cones you probably think of when you hear the words pine cone, internalize many of the early stages of development within a protective coating of scales and within the seeds they surround. Other plants have pollen and seeds. Notably, the evolutionary siblings of gymnosperms have both, as well as that other great innovation in plant reproduction, the flower. But cones are unique to conifers and their relatives. Conifers are not the only gymnosperms out there. 3 other groups, the palm-like cycads, the fan-leafed ginkgos, and the enigmatic and frankly kind of weird nidophytes, all evolved from the same cone-bearing ancestor. While all 4 groups used to live in the Northwest, in fact, all 4 grew together in southern BC while dinosaurs roamed among them in the Jurassic and Cretaceous periods, only conifers remain here today. Needles are what separate conifers from their gymnosperm relatives. Leaves are present in nearly all plants, but the earliest conifers evolved leaves that were narrow and skinny, or in a few cases, thin and scale-like. And whether they're the bottle brush-like needles of a Douglas fir, the flat needles of a hemlock, or the budding needles of a cedar, all subsequent conifers have inherited this trait. It's these modified leaves that may explain in part why conifers are so common in the Northwest. Winters here are generally mild, and plants that don't shed their leaves can grow all year here, but light levels can get perilously low for organisms that depend on solar energy to survive, as all trees do. The dark color of needles and the way they're organized on a conifer help them absorb more light during the famously sunless winters of the Northwest. As we'll see later in this series, many local conifers live in areas where they experience extreme cold during the winter or extreme drought during the summer, and the relatively small surface area of needles minimizes water loss and may give conifers a leg up over other plants in these harsh environments. For these and for many other reasons, conifers thrive in the Northwest, with dozens of species living here. This great diversity of conifers can be condensed down into 3 main groups. The first of these includes the most familiar trees: pines, hemlocks, spruces, firs, larches, and Douglas firs, which, confusingly, aren't firs at all, but a species unique to western North America. The second group includes the world's tallest trees, coast redwoods, as well as cedars and junipers. And finally, there's the weirdest of the lot, the yew, that's Y-E-W family. Unlike most other conifers, yews grow colorful, berry-like structures instead of cones, and our native species, the Pacific yew, is the source of the anti-cancer drug Taxol. As it happens, all 3 of these groups are present in the Puget Lowlands, so even a walk in a city park is a nice overview of Northwest conifer diversity. Due to logging, land use, and the growth of cities, there are no major tracts of Puget Lowlands forests left. Despite the huge reduction in the size of this ecosystem, patches of it remain in the form of protected areas in Washington and British Columbia. Many of these areas are on islands, where their remoteness has protected them from logging and development, such as Gulf Islands National Park Reserve in BC, and Moran and Deception Pass State Parks in Washington. The presence of these forests can be felt in other, more unexpected places as well. Perhaps the oddest of these is a green-roofed vivarium on the grounds of Seattle's Olympic Sculpture Park. Inside, you'll find a log, the remains of a large western hemlock that once grew along the Green River south of town, and it's slowly rotting away. If it were just a decomposing log, it'd be easy to interpret this as a piece of conceptual art, especially given its setting. But it's what else you'll see in the greenhouse that really drives home the importance of Northwest conifers to the forests in which they live. As the log decays, it releases nutrients and provides living space for ferns, flowering plants, young trees, insects, spiders, millipedes, and countless microbes. It's these complex communities that conifers quite literally support, both in life and death, that makes them so central to life in the Northwest. And it's these connections we'll explore in the next episode of this series, when we head to the dense, rain-soaked forests on the western slopes of the Cascade Mountains.